You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month, we talk to Lily Linden about her new queer rom-com, My Own Worst Enemy, to Talia Hibbert about her new young adult rom-com, Highly Suspicious and Unfairly Cute, as well as her appearance at Brighton Book Festival on June 24th. We also speak to two Brighton writers, Amy Lavelle and Jo Bedford, about their new books, Home Sweet Home and A Bad Decade for Good People. We also talk to the author of this month's book club book, Amita Murray, about her new novel, Unladylike Lessons in Love, a Regency romance with a difference. The show is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. Please do rate, review and subscribe. You can find us over on Instagram at BTM Book Club and find details of everything we spoke about in the podcast show notes. I loved recording this episode and hope you love listening. Emmy is her own worst enemy, so why does she fancy someone who looks like her? Overthinker and recent drama school graduate Emmy Clooney, no relation, will do anything to be successful despite the lack of her great roles for queer actors. But in the audition room for what could be her big break, Emmy meets rising star Mae Jones. Mae is the same casting type as Emmy, so they'll always be fighting for the same parts. Short-haired lesbian. Unfortunately, Mae is also charming, talented, and very, very hot, which means Mae is not just Emmy's casting type, but she's also her romantic type. When their opposite personalities clash, Emmy and Mae begin a fierce competition to win the best parts. But if they're cast in the same show, will they find a way to act nicely or take their rivalry to the next stage? Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club, Lily Linden.
Thank you so much for having me. What fun.
I love the premise for this book, which is basically what happens when I realise I'm attracted to someone that looks just like me.
Basically, yeah. It may or may not have inspiration in real life.
Well, that was my next question. When did the idea for My Own Worst Enemy come to you?
Well, I think it was a bit of a combination of things. I knew that I wanted to write about actors because I think it is a sort of world that I've always really loved, and a lot of my friends are actors. So I knew I wanted to write about actors. And then I think the other part came from my friends consistently teasing me about what my type is, which is, basically people who look like me. And I think the two ideas just sort of came together in, you know, who would be the worst, you know, person to fancy as an actor? It's your, you know, casting rival. And I loved the thought of my friend who's an actor kept telling me about the times that they, you know, meet the same people in audition rooms over and over again because they look a bit like you. And I'd said something like, God, that sounds like my absolute dream to walk into an audition room and there's just hundreds of people who look like me and they're all queers. It came out of wish fulfillment, really.
Can you read some, please, Lily?
I would love to. So this moment comes from time where we are in one of these audition rooms where Emmy and Mae have met, and they have already taken deep offense to each other for going up for the same parts. They may or may not be fancying each other at this point. They are definitely trying to pretend that they don't. Unfortunately, I must be amazing at manifesting. The next week, I get called in for the second round of another play about the AIDS crisis. And in the audition room, Mae sat there waiting for me, smirking. Jones, Clooney. We sit in charged silence. I'd planned 10 witty put-downs to say to her, but they've all suddenly gone from my mind. The three other actors in the room shuffle their chairs to turn away from us. Clearly, the tension between us is putting them off their preparation as much as it's putting me off mine. You look stupid, I say eventually. To be fair, her jumper is ridiculous, orange and fuzzy. I don't know how she could think it's appropriate. Ouch, she says, pretending to be stabbed in the heart. God, and I bet you worked so hard to rehearse that. She leans forward, resting her head on her chin to look at me. So how's our rivalry going for you? I haven't seen you on Broadway yet. The West End, I snap. I'm British. I'd be on the West End. Mae grins with the satisfaction of annoying me. One of the boys coughs. I lean forwards to hiss at her privately. How am I supposed to know who's winning the competition when I have no idea about what parts you've got? She shuffles her chair closer too. Clooney, have you been Googling me? I roll my eyes. What does she take me for? Obviously, thoroughly, but Mae Jones is nowhere to be found. She looks relieved, then cocky. She leans back, tilting her chair onto its back legs. It's a stage name, she says. I stare at her. You went to the effort of crafting a stage name and the surname you chose for yourself was Jones. She swings on her chair. I don't need a memorable name to be a memorable person. Having a quirky acting name would be overcompensating, don't you think? She rocks down in satisfaction, stretching her arms above her head. Above her fluffy sleeves, I can see she has a small tattoo on her right wrist. It's a navy blue wiggly sign that I think for a moment must be an infinity sign or a clumsy sea lion. I've always thought it's deeply unprofessional for actors to have tattoos. You should be a blank slate for whichever character you're going to become. But then I realised it's an and sign. What's so special to you about an ampersand? I ask. She glances at her wrist and then at me. I can tell you, but I promise you're going to hate it. I rear back. Oh my God, it's not some kind of sex thing, is it? Not exactly. She looks at her wrist, traces the blue line running over her veins. It's to remind me to be present in the moment I find myself in, she says, and say yes to whatever life presents to me. She looks up at me, her eyes sparkling. No, I say. Yes, she says. I groan. You mean yes and? We both laugh, then remember who the other is, and abruptly stop. I cannot believe you have an improv tattoo, I say, shaking my head. That is officially the saddest thing I've ever heard. And you are an expert on sad, she agrees.
Oh, big round of applause. That is so good. Oh my gosh, your dialogue is amazing. I cannot wait to read this book. So Lily, you are one of the queens, if I may, of queer romantic fiction.
Oh my God, you absolutely may.
Who are some of your other favourite rom-com writers?
Well, I have to say Laura Kay, who is my writing girlfriend. She is not actually my girlfriend, don't worry, Laura. But we met last year when our books were coming out at the same kind of time. And I think because we both write really fun queer rom-coms, we kept getting paired up together. And I love her books. And Wild Things is her latest one, which is coming out this month, about a bunch of gays who move to the countryside to renovate a house together. And it's so lovely and heartwarming. I would heartily recommend that. And I also love Lex Croucher. They write very fun historical books about queers through history, and I just think they're really fun. I've just started their first young adult novel, which is called Gwen and Art Are Not in Love, which is a sort of medieval queer love triangle romps. I love it.
Amazing. So I love this about you. You won a Comedy Women in Print prize for the funniest sex scene. So I want to talk about sex scenes. How do you get it wrong and how wrong do people get it? Especially queer fiction.
That is a very funny question. Yes. I think that it's possibly, I think there's nothing funnier than winning a prize for a funny sex scene, because everyone's just like, oh, I'm just a bit worried now. I think that the thing that can sometimes go wrong is maybe if people try to write something that is very erotic and it maybe doesn't translate to the page that well. I don't know. Maybe that's just me being a prude. But I think that what I really enjoy about writing things that are a bit flirty and a bit sexy is, you know, it's your characters. So it's just you understanding the characters in another way. And I really love when books feel kind of specific. It's not just writing a sex scene, it's writing that sex scene, you know, between those two characters, and the build up of the tension. I think I'm often teased a bit by Laura, for example, about I sort of love to have a lot of tension built up between my characters, where you keep thinking that they're finally gonna make out, and then maybe putting it off for a little bit longer, because for me there's nothing sexier than delay. I think I would be recommending to this is not the question you asked me, but I'm gonna answer it anyway, which is, if people were asking how do you write a funny sex scene, I would be suggesting think about character and, you know, what could be the, you know, worst thing that would happen to that specific character with their crush, and then how can you maybe make that into something that's very fun and lovely. There are so many different ways to be sexy, she says, as if she knows. Of course, I'm an incredibly sexy person. I'm blushing even talking about this.
What other advice would you give to writers working on romantic comedies in general?
Well, this is a fun one, because I also work as an editor, and it's quite fun to sort of put on my different hats. So I feel more confident in being able to give people advice as an editor of rom-coms than as a writer of one. Because of course I love to give other people advice that I then ignore. But I think that advice I would give might be to write something that you think is really fun. You know, for me, the best romantic comedies are all about romance. They're about romance and comedy. So maybe trying to think what would be something that you would find super romantic. Don't try to sort of write what you think other people would think is romantic, but what would be the most amazing story to happen to you? Or maybe you're lucky enough to, you know, have a big romance in your own story. And I think for me, some of the things that I love about romantic comedies are, you know, yes, they're full of these kind of dramatic grand gestures sometimes, but sometimes the most romantic things can be in tiny details. It doesn't have to be all about, you know, fireworks and huge grand celebratory things. Sometimes the most romantic thing to do is, you know, leave a post-it note or something. So yeah, it doesn't have to be big.
Well, what a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for coming on. How can we find and follow you?
Oh, I am on Instagram at Bookie McBookface, which I should probably change. I'm also on Twitter and TikTok at Lily Lindon, Lindon. But yeah, if you type in my name anywhere, hopefully I will come up. I'm the very cute one with the short hair.
That fancies herself.
That fancies herself. I'm gorgeous.
Rivalry or romance, these arch enemies can't decide. Bradley Graham is pretty much perfect. He's a star football player, manages his OCD well enough, and comes out on top on all of his classes, except the ones he shares with his ex-best friend, Celine. Celine Bangura is a conspiracy theory obsessed. Social media followers eat up her takes on everything from UFOs to holiday overconsumption, yet she's still not cool enough for the popular kids' table, which is why Brad abandoned her for the in crowd years ago. At least that's how Celine sees it. These days, there's nothing between them other than petty insults and academic rivalry. So when Celine signs up for a survival course in the woods, she's surprised to find Brad right beside her. Forced to work as a team for the chance to win a grand prize, these two teens must trudge through not just mud and dirt, but their messy past. And as this adventure brings them closer together, they begin to remember all the good parts about their history. But has too much time passed, or just enough to spark a whole new kind of relationship? Talia Hibbert, the author of this wonderful book, Highly Suspicious and Unfairly Cute, and is joining me here in the Brighton Book Club studio to talk about her book. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So congratulations on this new book, which has been described as a razor sharp, witty, enemies to lovers rom-com. Where did the inspiration come from?
Thank you. I have been reading romance for a really long time, and like any romance reader, I love tropes. Enemies loving each other in the end is one of my favorites, but friends loving each other is also one of my favorites, so I wanted to combine the two.
Can you read us some?
I can. Okay, so this is a couple of pages from the start of chapter two, and it's from Celine's point of view. If I'm going to study law at Cambridge next year, which I definitely am, I need at least an A in philosophy. That's the only reason I don't climb out of Mr. Taylor's window when I see Bradley standing in the doorway. He looks at me and visibly winces, like I'm dog poo or something. His mate Donno, who is deeply annoying but usually easy to ignore, much like a gnat, snickers from across the room. Bad luck, Bradders. My cheeks heat, with the burning hellfire of rage, obviously. People like them, popular people who think sports and looks and external validation are a replacement for actual personality, ironically don't have the social skills to deal with anyone outside their golden circle. I should know. Once upon a time, back when I was young and clearly going through some stuff because my decision-making matrix was severely off, I used to be best friends with Bradley Graham. Then he threw himself headfirst into the gelatinous beast that is popularity and was sucked away and transformed. Now he might as well be a slimy, shiny alien. I look him in the eye and let him see all my disdain. Bradley discovers the tiniest fragment of a spine somewhere within himself, storms over, and sits down next to me. Actually, he throws himself resentfully into the seat and smacks me in the face with his deodorant, or his aftershave, or whatever it is that makes him smell so strongly of just cut grass. Celine, Sonam whispers, leaning into my left side. Stop looking at him like that. Like what? I whisper back, but I already know what she means. I have this small problem where my feelings leak out of my face. If he turns up dead tomorrow, you're going to be arrested. Considering Sonam's permanently solemn expression, black-on-black outfit, and the way her lanky limbs barely fit under the table, this is like receiving an ominous tarot reading from a goth spider. You guys are rubbish at whispering, Bradley butts in, just so you know. I jerk in my seat, appalled that he would have the gall to speak to me so casually. For God's sake, we are enemies. There are rules to this sort of thing. He's not supposed to address me unless he's calling me a know-it-all or challenging me to a duel.
Thank you so much. It's such a strong voice and such a fabulous book. So, Talia, you also write saucy romance for adults, which is said in the best, most complimentary way possible. What's different for you about writing romance for adults and for young adults?
So one of the things or the challenges about writing YA for the first time that I really relished was that teenagers have kind of different concerns and different worlds to the world most adults live in. You know, they're concerned about the transition from childhood to adulthood, which is one of the most high pressure phases of your life. There's a lot of conflict in their lives because usually they're in the care of their family or adults who have been taking care of them and who have sort of told them what to do for so long, and they're expected to obey. But at the same time, they're also expected to be independent now and to be individuals and their own people. So one of the big differences, I think, with those coming of age themes and figuring out what you want from life, or figuring out if you have to figure that out yet. And I really liked writing that journey alongside the journey of their relationship.
Oh, that's such a good answer. Absolutely. So what tips do you have, Talia, for anyone that's looking to write in the genre?
Well, I'm not an expert on YA yet, but I think romance for all age groups has a lot, you know, in common. And so my tips for anyone who wants to write something romantic would be to remember that one of the special things about a romantic story is there's not one main character, there's multiple main characters. And that gives you the opportunity to really delve into so many different layers of growth and conflict. So I would say make the most of your main characters and their similarities and their differences.
So you are appearing alongside Mame Blue and Ore Abaje-Williams as part of Brighton Book Festival on a panel named You Cannot Be Serious. What can we expect from this?
So the title is very tongue-in-cheek, a sort of reference to the fact that books like ours, books that deal with romance and feelings and humour and happiness, are often considered less than in literary terms, and this idea that they can't cover serious subject matter, or that if a book doesn't cover serious subject matter, it lacks value. And, you know, the reality is that actually positive emotions are just as significant and important to us as individuals and to our society as anything more grim or hopeless. So, you know, I think we'll be discussing that. We'll be discussing preconceptions about certain genres, and we'll be discussing what makes books special.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you?
So I have a newsletter that you can sign up to from my website, taliahibbert.com. And I'm also on social media, where I am at Talia Hibbert on Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. And I'm author Talia Hibbert on Facebook.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Amy Lavelle is a Brighton-based writer and is here to tell us about her new novel, Home Sweet Home. Four women, one big decision. It's about to get messy. Poppy, Saffron, Rosemary and Sorel might be sisters, but they could not be more different. Oldest Poppy has hit all the milestones before turning 30, but constantly being in control is starting to feel a bit suffocating. Peacemaker Saffron will do anything to keep her sisters together, even at her own expense. Rosemary has crafted a perfect facade, but cracks in her engagement are beginning to surface. Youngest Sorel is pregnant after a one-night stand and is determined to do it all on her own for once, without any help from her sisters. But when they inherit their family home, the four must make the decision to keep or sell their house, and they're about to discover that no one gets under your skin quite like family. Can they ever put their differences aside and find a way to move forward together? Amy, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us about the inspiration behind Home Sweet Home?
Well, yeah, I have always been fascinated by big groups of sisters, you know, the March sisters, the Kardashian sisters. And so I really wanted to write something that explored that for this one. Big families, big mess. Yeah, the sister dynamic.
Are you part of a big family yourself?
I am. I have three sisters and two brothers, none of whom make it into the book. I should just say that up front. But I, yeah, so I've grown up with a lot of siblings, and yeah, I just really, I find that so fascinating, because I think every big family thinks that they're so different, and they have all the rules and, you know, all the dynamics. I don't think they're that different from any other big family, but I just think it's such a little club that you're in. And I love that dynamic and the psychology behind it. So I really want to just dig into that with this one. Plus, I wrote it in the pandemic when we're just all completely apart. So it's nice to kind of get into that space of being very together and very intimate.
Absolutely. Can you read us some, please?
Of course. This is from the point of view of Rosemary. Cyril came in after me and lay down on my bed, but I kept looking through the box. It was filled with random bits, some toys, bed sheets, a couple of books and notebooks. I lifted each thing out, inspecting it carefully and breathing it in. I had forgotten about this, I said, looking through an old diary. I had a set of rules Sol and I had made for being sisters. We listed each other as the most important people in the family, who everyone else had to listen to. I turned back to her and smiled. Isn't it nice to be back? I wish we could do this more, come back whenever without worrying about there being other people staying here. Although it feels weird knowing it's ours now. It feels different, don't you think? I'm pregnant, Cyril said. I dropped the diary. What? Maybe I'd heard wrong. Maybe she said poignant. It was poignant being back here. She couldn't be pregnant. She couldn't be. This was Cyril. Cyril! I'm pregnant, she said. Again. It sounds a lot like the first time she had said it, which meant I probably wasn't mishearing her. I was finding it hard to breathe. It felt as if I'd been winded. I opened and closed my mouth, trying to suck in air. Cyril was pregnant. Cyril was? Oh, I said. Although it wasn't so much the word as an expulsion of air. I tried to make my mouth move. How could this be happening? Cyril wasn't even in a relationship. She didn't even like anyone at the moment. I would know. She would tell me. She always told me. This must be a mistake. It was all a mistake. She probably had the dates wrong, and actually, her period wasn't due for another week. That had happened before, probably. She would tell me the dates, and it wouldn't make sense, and that's how I'd realise she'd made a mistake. We would laugh. It would become the joke of the day. Cyril thought she was pregnant, but actually, her period is still a wake away. How late are you? I asked. Cyril looked at the ceiling. A couple of weeks. The pregnancy test said I was about 5 weeks. Oh, I said again. Oh no. She was late, and she'd taken a test, and the test had told her she was 5 weeks already. I was finding it a lot harder to process information all of a sudden, but what I was realising was that this wasn't a joke. Those tests were accurate, and false positives were rare. I knew this because all the times I spent on forums hoping my negative result was false and looking for confirmation from other people. But false positives? Those didn't happen. Not really. She was pregnant. Sorrel. Sorrel was pregnant. You're going to have a baby, I said. This is really happening. I shook myself and told myself to be happy for her, that this was good news, that I needed to be there for her. Okay, so it wasn't my baby. I wasn't pregnant. Again, me, the sister who was engaged and desperately wanted this, I wasn't pregnant. But Sorrel, the sister who never even thought about having kids, who didn't even like playing with dolls growing up, she was. This was happening to her, not me, to her. I could hear myself asking all the questions I was supposed to ask, but I still couldn't breathe properly. And in the meantime, my chest seemed to be getting tighter. Soon I would suffocate.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So there's a lot in this book about grief. And I know you've experienced some of this yourself. How has your own experiences in this informed the story?
It was interesting because I set out to write something that wasn't autobiographical, despite having sisters and big family. My first book was about grief and it was very autobiographical. And I didn't want to do it this time. But then I was writing it, I was realizing I was ruminating so many on things I hadn't even considered when I started this about grief and motherhood. And I think, again, like I said, I wrote it in the pandemic. So it's such a weird time. So it's really hard not to be feeling a lot of different emotions and to be really processing these feelings of grief and loss and separateness and separation all the time. So I think it sort of fled in without me meaning it to, and I sat back at the end of it and thought, oh yeah, there are all these themes I hadn't even thought about. So it wasn't a conscious decision, but it's just, I guess I had all that time to be thinking about things that it just made its way in,
basically. So you've got four protagonists basically in this book. How did you maintain their voices and build those characters to keep them distinctive?
I did a lot of thinking about them before I started. I was really aware of how sometimes you can, especially if it's siblings, some siblings get lost, as you know, to quote the master, Pride and Prejudice. You know, you have, they're all really strong sisters, but you've got Mary, who is just that one in the corner who's annoying. And you can't really do that if you're writing from the point of view of Mary. So I really spent lots of time mapping out their childhoods, their woes, their icks, to try and really get in their heads. And then once I started writing, it was just it came quite easily to me, I think. I really felt like I knew these girls, so I was really excited to get back to each one and explore her, the drama going on in her life for the next chapter.
What advice, Amy, would you give to any aspiring writers listening?
Okay, I would say the best writing advice I've ever been given isn't mine. It came from Beth Miller, another fantastic, well, say another, a fantastic writer. Arse on chair. You can't edit a blank chair. You can't edit a blank page, and don't get it right, get it writ. So I think that's it. You just have to put the time in. Even if you don't feel it, don't wait for the muse. Just sit down with a paper or a computer, whatever, and just start. And that's the only way to get it done.
So you are a Brighton-based writer. Who are some of your other favourite Brighton-based writers?
Oh, that's a really tough one. I love Beth Miller's work. As I said, she was my tutor. I did the creative writing course in Brighton. She was my tutor on it. And she was just so fantastic. Her wisdom is incomparable. And I love her book. She's so funny. So if you play another Brighton writer, she's fantastic. Oh, God. I love your new book. Yeah, I mean, there's so many great writers in Brighton, aren't there? I think we're really lucky to come from such a creative space.
Absolutely. Do you have favourite places in Brighton that you like to read and write?
I really like to be outside with a book. And I think, again, we're so lucky to have so many nice places that we can do that here. Like the Pavilion Gardens, I spent a lot of time there in my youth. And it's nice to be able to go back there. Writing spaces. Oh, just find me a cafe. Just find me something that isn't my house and I will be there.
What's next for you, Amy? What are you working on?
I'm working on something new right now, although I'm on maternity leave as well, so it's slightly on and off. But I'm working on my next project. I'm trying not to talk about too much yet because it's all a bit up in the air, but I'm very excited about it.
And how can we find and follow you?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram, Lavelle Actually at both. That's LaveLle Actually. Find me there.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jo Bedford's debut novel, A Bad Decade for Good People, is out now with Parthian Press. Brighton, 2016. Laurie wears the scar given to her by a policeman's baton as a mark of pride among her circle of bright young activists. Her conscientious but sensitive brother, George, should be a part of that circle until the appearance of enigmatic Spanish migrant Antonio threatens to divert him from his sister's world of marches and moral accountability. As the clouds gather over Brighton and the EU referendum accelerates both Laurie's political zeal and Antonio's ambiguous desires, George is faced with the fact that their city of parties and protests is suddenly a place where the possibility of saving the world, as well as the people around him, is in jeopardy of being lost forever. At once a letter of support to everyone disillusioned by British politics and a deeply perceptive snapshot of modern relationships, A Bad Decade for Good People is a captivating state of the nation tale that begs the question, when it feels like the world is falling apart, how do you keep those you love from doing the same? Joe, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Tell us about the inspiration behind A Bad Decade for Good People.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very much a Brighton novel, you know, and my love of Brighton was like one of the early sparks and as a place that like deserves celebration, but also my concern with Brighton and the way that it, particularly the way that the community has been affected since the referendum and about that kind of, I mean, you maybe will remember the same, but like that sort of crushing surprise and shock and anguish about the way that whole thing went. And then in the years since, obviously, like it's inescapable how terribly bleak things can go from day to day. I mean, even like obviously this week, with the NATSI conference in London, like people, particularly in Brighton, where there's so much emphasis on love and pride and unity, and that is really built into the language of the city, to have a political environment which increasingly fails to reflect that in any meaningful way is hard on an individual Brightonian, on an individual English person, a British person, a European. It's something that I was working out how to deal with, and I was trying to work out how I felt about it and what my opinion of the whole thing was, and how to assimilate this new political reality into my everyday life and my discourse and my relationships. And like many people who are inclined to write fiction, like I obviously work it out by making it into a little story. And essentially it grew from there.
Can you read us some, please, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I will. If I may, I'll read just a short section from the first page. If the policeman's baton had found Laurie half an inch lower, she would be blind in one eye. Instead, it left her with a long crescent-shaped scar, which she wore like a medal, never hiding it and never knowing how it made my stomach flip. Every time I saw it, I had to shake off the memory of her blood running down over her eyelids and onto her jacket, and afterwards the stitching and the gooey rivets it left behind, and a halo of yellow bruising that hung around the socket for weeks. Her scar was all I could see while she pleaded with me by the side of the road, until we were lit in the headlights of Dad's car, and then running, slipping, gripping each other's clothes in the ditch. I remember the sound of Dad's voice carrying over the hum of the engine, the faint warmth coming through Laurie's jacket as she held me, the smell of mud and silage. The hills opposite looked like the silhouette of a man sleeping on his side, cut against the stars, the kind of thing you notice at midnight in the countryside with someone who makes you feel as though things could be better. That and the raw feeling that your failure isn't yet total, but just another blip in time waiting to pass. We tried not to laugh aloud as Dad stumbled back into his car, slammed the door and sped away. After that, Laurie was earnest again and pleading for me to pack it in at the pub and come away with her to Brighton, where she'd found the perfect place for us to carve something out, her words, where Helena was waiting, whose name she couldn't mention without smiling. "I just want to make it right," I said, but she didn't recognize my guilt, never could. She just pointed the torch up to her chin and pulled a face, which forced me to laugh. The stars above her head disappeared, and I saw the long, moon-shaped line of damage illuminated above her eye. Half an inch lower, that eye would be blind, I thought. Then she'd be someone else, and I'd be someone else, though she'd always be my sister.
Thank you very much. That's such a powerful opening to a novel. How do you balance, Joe, anguish, tension, sadness, and despair with hope in the book?
Yeah, I think that's a really pertinent question for, I mean, not just for myself having written into that space consciously, but for anyone who's writing at the moment with a sense that they want to reflect something about the real world or how they might prefer the world to be. I think the best writers are unconsciously in a process of trying to shape the world, because no one likes it when you've got an axe to grind, right? But in order to do that, I feel like unless hope is at the center and unless a love for people and a belief that human beings are equally valuable, like unless that's at the center, then you're always in danger of succumbing to that kind of anxiety or anguish or despair. And some writers that you feel have edged towards that emotional space, you know, there are different ways to respond to it. And one of them is cynicism, which is not necessarily always useful. But another way is that sort of resistant hope, that active form of hope, which I had in my mind throughout writing the book. So I think in order to tell the story of contemporary political life, unless you leave the door open to the fact that we still have political agency, which I do believe that we do in with all my heart, then you risk leaving the reader paralyzed. And that's a real danger within our discourse at the moment, because things do look so difficult and the challenges just seem to like pile one on top of the other after the other after the other. But Brighton in particular, there are many places in the UK in which hope is imbued into the narrative of the city. In fact, most of the major cities have that as part of their story. But Brighton does wear it on its sleeve. And when I'm in Brighton, I don't live in Brighton anymore, but when I visit, I feel that the people are positively engaged still with political life. And when you see that, you can borrow from that. And that is what I've attempted to do with the book.
When you were writing A Bad Decade for Good People, did you find out anything about Brighton that kind of surprised you?
I did a lot of reading about Brighton, and it's a funny place because, you know, it's built out of that kind of Regency era tourism thing. So one of the things that I kind of learned, I suppose, or like tried to assimilate into the structure was that everyone who lives in Brighton will know that when you are walking around the streets, if you throw a stick, you're just as likely to hit someone who's not from Brighton originally as you are to hit someone from Brighton. In fact, if you go around the middle of town, you will struggle to hit someone with a stick who was born in Brighton and still lives in Molescombe or Coldin or somewhere like this. So one of the things that I tried to get on top of with my reading was like working out who's here, like who's in Brighton, like, and what are their lifestyles like? Because although, you know, my entry point was that sort of, you know, the pride stuff and, you know, the rainbow and the love and unity and that outward facing, you know, aspect of Brighton's reputation, like we have loads of different types of people and their stories, partly because we have lots of people coming from all over the world, as well as people who are like old school Brighton, Sussex people, like their stories are massively divergent. And there's a really rich history, which sits somewhere underneath our pride. I say our, because I still feel like a part of the city, but still sits underneath our primary reputation, the thing that we're kind of known for and the thing that if you were a Londoner and you wanted to go away for the weekend to Brighton, you would expect to see. So that was one of the layers, other than the history and the deeper history and the fact that Brighton's not a very old place, you know, but still, you know, things have happened. And the literary tradition, like the books about Brighton, of which there are multiple fantastic novels. The people's stories go much deeper than you will access in a weekend. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're a big writer of short stories and a prize winning writer of short stories. What are the big differences between writing short stories and novels?
I was having this discussion yesterday with another writer, and we were talking about how sometimes short stories are seen as like a warm-up to a novel, and even more patronizingly, flash fiction is seen as a warm-up to short stories. And this is a myth that has no real use for any of us, because the form, you know, that sort of interchange between form and content, like what do I want to say and how much space do I want to use to say it, like that's a really crucial and conscious decision that writers make, like this story belongs in 5,000 words or this story belongs in 100,000 words. If you're writing a fantasy world building epic, like you can do it in short story form, but you might want to stretch your legs so that you can build more castles and have more dragons flying around and all of that, you know. Whereas if you're doing a snapshot into a point of crisis in a person's emotional life, like when they break down in a supermarket, like which which if you live around here you do see something, but if you want to focus on that point of crisis, then you might say, okay, well, the most effective way to do that will be in 1,000 words, you know, and a piece of flash comes from that. So I feel like the differences between short stories and novels is, you know, it's not just the size, it's the fact that the story is suited to that size. And then you have the huge, rich history of literary tradition that is bespoke, relevant to each form. So like if you write short stories, then you should definitely be reading short stories like as much as you can, obviously. And same for novels. If you don't read novels and you're writing a novel, then it's time to like review and think about that again. But yeah, the difference is it's chalk and cheese. They're not two different musical genres. Like they're two different forms of art in my perspective.
And what's next for you, Joe? What are you working on?
I'm very lucky at the moment because I was awarded a scholarship for to do a PhD. So at the moment I'm in a place where I don't have to go to a terrible job and then write in the evening. I can write all day and then wonder what the hell I'm supposed to do in the evening, you know. So I'm very I'm in a really good place of writing at the moment. What I'm working on is a composite novel about, again, like about contemporary Britain, about real people and about, you know, the things that concern me, but with a new focus on nature. I came to nature writing very, very late in terms of what I read, and then in the last few years I've really engaged with it and began to understood what it's about, and so I will write in a more rural tradition, I think, whereas Bad Decade for Good People is very urban and it's very, you know, openly about urban life. Now I get to take long walks in the countryside and think about geese and all of that. So that's where I'm at.
Thank you so much for joining us, Joe. How can we find and follow you?
Well, you're more than welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is @JoeBedford_UK. A Bad Decade for Good People is available at all the big names, or you can get it direct from the publisher or from a number of bookshops, including a fair few in Brighton. If you search for it, you will find it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna.
Our book club book this month is Amita Murray's Regency Romance and Ladylike Lessons in Love. Not every Regency lady is looking for a husband. As the daughter of an English earl and his Indian mistress, impulsive Leela Marley has already broken the rules of society into tiny pieces. When a face she never thought she would see again appears and begs for help, Leela must court notoriety once more and pit her wits against the annoyingly handsome aristocrat, Ivor Tristan. But does she risk opening her heart to the one person who can break it? Amita, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations.
Anna, thank you so much. And what a lovely introduction. I did love hearing it in your voice.
Can you tell us about the inspiration behind And Ladylike Lessons in Love?
You know, a lot of inspiration is so impulsive. You kind of just follow whatever your intuition is telling you, I suppose. When you look back, then you start to piece together what might have been the inspiration. And I have to say, Georgette Hare, you know, I absolutely love Georgette Hare. You might have seen my tweets in the last few days gushing about her. I started reading her when I was a teenager. You know, I was a pretty lonely teenager, I must say, you know, anxious and lonely. And I had lots of friends, but I was also easily lost in my head. And, you know, just spent loads of time listening to a lot of music and reading a lot of books. So Georgette Hare was one of those people I could just lose myself in her world. She created a world that's just so hair, you know, that's where a lot of Regency comes from. Women falling into ponds and people running away on runaway horses and, you know, putting your bedsheet down the window and running off somewhere. That's her. So a lot of what we think of when we think of Regency, we might connect it to Jane Austen, but actually it's Georgette Hare. So I do think that, you know, a lot of my love for Hare goes into the Marley Sisters series. At the same time, as you know, and I know we're going to talk about this, the kind of the diversity angle is so important to me, and female sexual agency is so important to me. So both those two things come in as well.
So to talk about that, it's amazing to see diversity in Regency period books here and on the screen with things like Bridgerton. Can you speak a bit to this?
Yes. So because of my love for Hare, she was affecting everything I wrote. Yeah. And it doesn't work for everything because Regency is a particular style. But I didn't know, you know, as a brown writer, Indian origin, like what, you know, what was my place going to be in Regency? Funnily enough, hadn't occurred to me to actually try writing any Regency. So it was Bridgerton and Shonda Rhimes' take on Julia Quinn's Bridgerton that really changed something. And I think it opened a little door, you know, for a lot of writers. So what she does really cleverly, I mean, you know, well, it's clever and it's sort of not completely accurate, which is that it shows people of colour kind of seamlessly blending into London society, which is lovely and something to aspire to, but it wasn't necessarily exactly how it might have been in the 1800s. You also see wealthy people in Bridgerton, and you know, I also wanted to kind of look at the working classes, what we now call the working classes. I started looking into it, you know, is this accurate? Like, who were the people of colour in this country in the early 1800s? And it turned out, well, there were quite a lot. So Lila Marley, so Lila and her sisters, they're daughters of an English earl who went off to India and, you know, he lived there and worked there like many, many people in the East India Company did. And he had a mistress there who was Indian, and they had daughters. So now I won't give away too many spoilers, but something happens to them because of which the girls, when they're little, move to London. So now you've got Lila and her sisters in London, where, you know, they're both beautiful and interesting and enticing, but also strange to a lot of people. So I kind of play with that a little bit, being a sort of an outsider. You know, what does that feel like? And I play with that. In terms of diversity, you know, there are other forms of diversity I look at. So class, I mentioned before, working classes. What, you know, what about the staff that works in the house? What they need to have names, and they need to have personalities. So that was really important to me. Then we have a queer relationship that spans the series. In fact, it doesn't resolve I hope that's not a big spoiler, but it doesn't resolve in the first series. So I make sure that, you know, what we call diversity now was very much present then, but wasn't necessarily something that authors have explored. So I wanted to.
Can you read us some, please?
I'd love to. And this is a nice little segue, actually, because I chose an excerpt instead of about Leela's romance with Ivor or the mystery. I have actually chosen a little excerpt, which is with her best friend, Kenneth, who I just mentioned a second ago. So I think he's really, really funny, which is a funny thing to say about your own character. But they become real to me. So, you know, I'm talking about Kenneth as if he's a person. Okay. The front door opened, and one of the footmen ushered in a vision. It was her friend, Kenneth Lordsley. He came in, sauntered in, one should say, looking resplendent. His coat was a muted purple velvet, his waistcoat gold floral silk. His pantaloons fitted him so well, they may as well have been painted on, and the eyes, the disdainful eyes, and the walking stick he twirled were a work of art. He wanted to come across as nothing so much as indolent. People who tried too hard, he said, were the very worst kind of people. He stood there staring at Lila. Darling, you look positively inflamed. Whatever is the matter? Can you not give a chap a chance to wake up at a decent hour before sending urgent missives? You know what time I got to bed. I don't care, she said, dragging him into the living room. Here, mind the coat, he said, sounding more like the Kenneth she had known since they were both 20 and met at Vauxhall. Never mind the coat, she said impatiently. I need you to take me to the rat pit tonight. I would go by myself, but I have a feeling it wouldn't be the thing, and I don't even know where it is, though I'm nearly sure it must be in Covent Garden. I mean, I suppose I could find it by myself. It isn't that hard. He was looking askance at her. He had the most beautiful cherub curls made of spun sunshine. Darling, you're alarming me, he said. I know women don't go to the rat pit, at least not women with a reputation, but I don't have one, said Lila. But you know, that's not the main thing, he said. You seem like you want to do things. It's wearying, just looking at you. Well, Lila knew that. It was fashionable to lie half the day on a chaise and not want to do things. She knew it was very unfeminine. Yes, she said meekly, I see what you mean. My teachers were always sure I'd end up joining the Blue Stocking Society. Kenneth placed himself, puddle fashion, on a chair and looked to be blending into the upholstery trickle by trickle. He already looked half asleep. I suppose you'll go whether I escort you or not. Yes, Lila said, Well, then you take matters out of my hands, which, as a matter of fact, I greatly prefer. It's exhausting trying to make decisions. I'd much rather you put me on a leash and told me where to sit. He then says, you know, Leela, I'm hearing the most riveting rumours that you're planning on driving the curricle in my stead for the Brighton race. You know, every man between here and Brighton will gawk at you, look you up and down, and take you for a fast one. You'd lose your reputation entirely, if you had one, that is. Her eyes glittered. They will they? And how is that different from what they already think? I have a good mind to do it, you know. It'll teach people a lesson, that's for sure. Stop trying to distract me, he says. I swear there is no one whose mind runs in as many directions as you. It is not at all relaxing. But then he tells her that she may as well stop trying to blend in and be completely outrageous because no one's going to accept her anyway. So I'm going to stop there. But that's, that to me is Kenneth and Leela perfectly, perfectly shown.
Did you find out anything really interesting about Brighton during the Regency period?
You know, I'm going to look into it a bit more because the different books are set in slightly different places. So the first one is very much London-based. The second one has a bit of Folkestone in it. And the third one has Devon in it. So the fourth one ventures into Yorkshire. So now I've got, you know, I've got a few more left there. So I think I'm going to have to choose Brighton. One of the fascinating things about Brighton was, so very often when we see London in the Regency, it's usually springtime. It's usually the springtime period because that's when the balls and the soirees and the tea dances would happen. That was the social season every year. But then coming to the end of the social season, people used to feel that it would get too hot in London. Literally, it would get too hot. It would be too foggy. It would be too smelly. And they would go off to the seaside. So Margate and places like that were quite popular. But Brighton was one of the most popular. And the Prince Regent, of course, made it really, really popular with the pavilion and everything. So the Prince Regent, which is King George IV, really made Brighton quite a sort of a social center in the summer, and people used to kind of flock there, wealthier people, obviously. So yes, I think there's a book there in the offing.
Absolutely. So Leela is such an engaging character. How do you develop characters through a series and keep them so engaging?
Oh, thank you. That's a really nice thing to say. She does share annoying qualities with me, I'd say. You know, one of the things that I think is quite annoying about her, actually, is that when she's feeling vulnerable, she's just not someone who can show it. She will do everything she can for you not to see that. So she'll be more animated, more sociable. She'll chatter a lot. And that's what I do, I realize. That's what I do when I'm feeling vulnerable. So if I'm being quite sort of, yay, yeah, let's go do that, let's do fun things, it may be hiding, you know, however I'm actually feeling in the social situation. So she does have that quality. And that was something, I quite wanted to explore in her, how she kind of keeps people at a distance sometimes by doing that. But each of the sisters has her own personality. So that was really important to me. And what I tend to do is I spend a lot of time letting that character develop first before I let them then dictate the plot and let them dictate the love story, because I think the chemistry has to come from the two characters really kind of, you know, having something magical happen between them. Character is like super, super important to me, absolutely.
So as well as Regency romance, you also write contemporary mystery. How is or is the process different for you?
That's a really good question. And I'm, you know, I will carry on looking at what to do with my Aria Winter's contemporary series. To me, that's a really, really important one because I can explore something in that series that I can't in the Regency series. One, obviously, it's a bit more modern, so you can look at sort of female agency, feminism, sexuality in a slightly different way than you can in the Regency. Though I do try there as well. But in the contemporary, Aria Winters to me is she's neurodivergent. So we're looking at diversity in a slightly different way there. And to me, that's really important, the way her brain is wired differently and not in a normative way. And how to kind of play with that is really, really something that I quite enjoy doing with her character. And hers, even though there's a romantic element, the main thing is a mystery, and it's the other way around in the Regency. But I think the common thread probably, and this probably comes from my love of people like Wodehouse and Hare and others, is the comedy. I love doing comedy. So I do really like comedic dialogue. You know, that's something that's really, really important to me.
What is next for you, Amita?
Oh, so I've now written 2.5 more of the Regency series of books. So Marley Sisters. So I've got Anya done and Mira done, and I'm working on a fourth now, and I won't say any more about that at the moment. That the fourth one, I mean. So yeah, I mean, just to kind of you know, throw a little bit in the pond there. Anya is the second sister. She works in Queen Charlotte's court. And, you know, you never know if it's ever adapted for TV. Maybe we can get our Queen Charlotte that we love, you know, to play her. But so she works in Queen Charlotte's court as a musician. So that was something that I had never seen in Regency before, and I wanted to explore it. And Mira, the third sister, is a writer. And she, in the start of the book, no one knows, no one other than her sisters actually know that she is the writer, because she writes under a pen name. So that's next. But I do, you know, I keep on experimenting. I'm nothing if not a restless, hoppy hummingbird. So I am always experimenting. So yeah, I will tell you when the next thing comes.
And how can we find Anne Frye?
You can find me at Amita Murray. That's my Instagram and my Twitter name. So I would love, you know, I would love for readers to engage with this book and tell me, you know, what they thought of the book and the characters. I would love that. I have to confess, I'm good at Twitter. Well, good. I'm not bad at Twitter. Instagram does scare me still. So, you know, I'm learning. So if I ever, I'm slow to get back on Instagram. It's just because it scares me. It's not actually, it's not personal. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Anna. It was lovely to chat.
Thank you for tuning in. We are taking a short break over the summer, but we'll be back with a new show on July the 22nd. This means you have plenty of time to read our next book club book, which is Claire Fuller's The Memory of Animals. Here is the blurb. Neffy is a young woman running away from grief and guilt and the one big mistake that has derailed her career. When a debilitating new virus sweeps across the globe, volunteering in a vaccine trial offers her a way to make up for her past. But then the virus mutates and the future she had dreamed of for herself is gone. As the London streets outside the medical unit fall silent and food begins to run out, Neffy must decide where safety lies. Might she find solace by revisiting her own heady memories of the past? Can she trust the strangers trapped inside with her, despite her growing suspicions? Or is her best chance of a future to be found in the terrifyingly unknown world outside? Haunting and compelling, The Memory of Animals is a novel about freedom and captivity, survival and sacrifice, and what we cling to when everything else has been taken away. From the Costa Award-winning, Women's Prize shortlisted author of Unsettled Ground. If you have an idea for the show, you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. In the meantime, keep reading, enjoy the sun, and we'll be back in